G'day, welcome back to English History, Fact and Fiction, episode the 313th.
And I cop all this shit all the time and I'm sick of it. Absolutely sick of it.
My name's Dick Newman, let's get on with it. Just a tiny taster there of the Sonata for Flute and Harp by Joseph Bologne, who was the subject of last week's historical fiction. Our black guy coming up soon in our timeline. But what's this about this episode being called I Cop All This Shit All The Time and I'm Sick of It, Absolutely Sick of It? Because that's not what's going on. Henrietta Howard has no headache. Isn't that marvellous? Her friends can't believe she's transformed. It's Happy Henrietta. We haven't seen that before. And work can go on at Marble Hill again, and in a year it's going to be finished. Yeah, it's all happiness, because that dipshit Charles is gone from the legal separation. Now, what else happened last week? Well, I suppose we had the silly behatting, did we not? And George too has been a bit of a dick, but Carolyn's got him under control, I think. Right, back to Henrietta Howard, and it's all great, except she's got that job with Queen Carolyn, and it's pretty hard to get back out of it, which Henrietta wouldn't mind doing right now. It looks like George is tiring of his ageing mistress, and Carolyn is keeping her on just to make sure George doesn't find some young chubby chick to replace Henrietta, because he might fall in love with the new one. Letters to her friends speak of her frustration at now being chained to a place she wants to leave. Yeah, well, tough titties, Henrietta. Now let us return to the story that while Paul was out briefly for Compton, then back pretty soon thanks to Carolyn. There are competing stories on this. We had pressure from the Frenchies and the Dutchies for George to maintain the same guys in the ministry so he could just continue that happy foreign policy that we've had. That pressure is genuine. That happened. And it may have happened because of Walpole, the master manipulator, making sure it happened. We also had plenty of observers to tell us that Walpole was the guy behind pretty much everything royals. He was manipulating Carolyn, who in turn was manipulating poor old thick George. If so, then perhaps he was really clever, because it seems that both George and Carolyn really thought that they were the ones running the show, and neither tolerated opposition to what they wanted. So they both think they're running the show, they both think they're getting what they wanted, but according to the history, it's all Walpole. We do know that Walpole and Carolyn developed secret signs. Walpole would do the signalling by things like taking snuff or playing with his hat or fidgeting with his sword. Am I missing something? Brain is asking. Oh, reading of the will seems to be the thing. That is German George's will. We haven't read that, so let's read it. Oh, sorry, no will for you. You may recall that German George was thinking about his will, making multiple copies to send around the place. That was down to his wishes about separating the British silly hat gig from the Hanover elector gig. So new George, George II, has the will that was in England. It was in Lambeth Palace, to be precise, and the Archie said, "Here, mate, here's the will." So George got it, but he hasn't read it, apparently. It's still sealed, and it's staying that way until he gets the rest. That's what he's telling us. There are two others, one in the court of the Duke of Brunswick Wolfenbuttel, and the third in the Imperial Court in Vienna. It will cost the British taxpayer a pretty penny or two or three, and plenty of time to get those wills, but George will do it. It'll take 10 years before he's got all three wills, and so can unseal and have a good old read. Well, maybe. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. What he did do was suppress them, and so all we can say is to old dead German George. So there. Your son got the last laugh, and your final wishes can go to the grave with you, you wanker. Young Fred hadn't been invited to the silly beheading ceremony. I mentioned that last week, I'm pretty sure. And we are speculating that it was because of his friendship with Granddad German George. But George and Carolyn have that younger son, William Augustus, the good boy. It seems that he and Dad got on really well. 5-year-old William will raise a company of boys around the same age and have them parading around and learning the soldering stuff. Now, for the first 7 years of his life, William George is, for all intents and purposes, the only son. And it seems that George and Carolyn are not explaining that he's the spare heir. Here's a report from the Earl of Egmont. I was told today that the King, jesting with the Duke, his son, that's William Augustus, and asking him which he would rather be, a king or a queen, he replied, "Sir, I never yet tried. Let me be one of them a month, and I'll tell you." Yes, jesting. Oh, ha, ha, ha. Well, apart from the dubious thing about talking about, do you want to be a queen, it's not a really good subject to joke around with the spare heir.
Spare heir may be straight off to the men of Kent, raising rebellion because he wants to be the king or queen.
What old German George wanted was to have Willie Augustus to be the Elector in Hanover and Fred as King of Britain. But it looks like George II and Caron want to have it as Willie Augustus as King of Britain and Fred can just stay in Hanover as Elector. And look, that seems like a fair call. Fred has remained a German while Willie Augustus was born in England. Fred, though, has been made Duke of Gloucester and is getting English lessons. He then applied himself, so German George made him Duke of Edinburgh as well. Young William didn't miss out. He got Baron of the Isle of Alderney, Viscount of Tremayton in the county of Cornwall, Earl of Kennington in the county of Surrey, Marquis of Bermhamstead in the county of Hertford, and Duke of the county of Cumberland. Oh, crikey. Can you remember it all? What it looks like right now is that George and Carolyn are on the path of Willie Augustus to be our next king, and Fred can just hang out in Germany. Otherwise, surely they would have called Fred over to London. But a bit after a year after German George died, the invitation finally arrived, and in December 1728, young Fred turned up in London. No cheering, no waving, no guns banging, no bonfires.
Something must be wrong.
Contemporaries viewed it as George and Carolyn worked out that they really had to invite their son over to make sure we all knew what was going on. Fred, though, might have had different plans to his mum and dad's plans. There was another reason for Fred to come in, and that was about marriage. And this might actually be the right story. So, are you sitting comfortably? Good, I'll tell you the story.
It goes to German George liking to marry Hanoverian daughters to Prussian sons. He'd done well in that, and he's looking at two more. Granddaughter Anne, daughter of George and Carolyn, to his Prussian grandson Fred. And then Hanoverian Fred, son of Carolyn and George, our guy, to George's niece, Wilhelmine, daughter of German George's sister, Sophia Dorothea. And if you're saying, are we getting back to being rather inbred? Well, yeah, we haven't stopped not being inbred, really. Sophia Dorothea was all for it, but her man, Fred William, wasn't so keen. Because of that, German George was keeping it all pretty secret. George and Carolyn didn't know. But then when German George died, George too found out about it and said, "Grafting my half-witted son upon a mad woman would not mend the breed." Yeah, a bit tough there, George. While that was happening, Fred had decided to press on with fulfilling German George's plan. So he sent Lieutenant Colonel August de Lamotte off on a mission to secure the marriage with Wilhelmine. George too found out about that, so young Fred was kidnapped at a masquerade ball in Hanover, bundled up on a ship and sent to London on the quiet to parents who no longer cared much about him. It's dear little William Augustus for them. He's the favourite, not Fred. So that is the story. Am I sure? Not at all, because later claims will come out to change this story. That is, Carolyn was fine with Fred marrying Wilhelmine, but was herself doing the matchmaking. In Carolyn's case, she was looking to get Wilhelmine's sister, Frederica, married to Carolyn's nephew, Charles of Ansbach. Fred getting Lieutenant Colonel August de Lamotte was interfering with Carolyn's plans, and so Fred was kidnapped, etc. One way or another, it seems that Fred was kidnapped and bundled over to England on the quiet. His long overdue reunion with Mum and Dad will be Fred on the carpet being told what a very naughty boy he is, and it's not all hugs and kisses. What we can take from this is that something was very wrong for the lad to come into London on the quiet to a no sort of official reception at all. They will be saying, oh, we were just looking to protect him from people looking for a job. But yeah, we all smelt the bullshit in that. Now, the royals parade around unless they're in disgrace. Once we get past that, then for George, it's, hey, look at this new toy for me to play with, yeah, Fred. While Paul will assess Fred and say, I think this is not a son I need to be much afraid of. Caroline, it seems, won't be rushing to judgment, and we'll just sit back and see how it goes. Fred is short and perhaps what we could call petite. He is neat, graceful and lively. He winks at servants and he scoffs down jelly because he thinks jelly is an aphrodisiac. He's got his mum's intelligence and his dad's bulging eyes. Fred can now have a look at Carol and his mum. There's a lot more of her than he would have remembered. She can actually no longer ride a horsey. He's just a bit too chubby now. Like our previous royals, she also has gout. Just to make her look bigger, we still have the frocks with the big hoops in it. So Lady Mary Wortley Montagu can tell us, Majesty with sweeping train, that does so many yards contain, superior to a waiting nymphs, a lobster to attendant shrimps. Oh, that's not a bad poem, is it? I think we'll have that again. Majesty with a sweeping train that does so many yards contain, superior to her waiting nymphs as lobster to attendant shrimps. I like it. I really like that one. Carolyn also liked that everyone admired her coronation bling, so she now wears a stomacher with lots and lots of sparkly diamonds attached. Yeah, sparkling in the sunshine is Carolyn's signature frock now. Time for Fred to meet his sister Anne, who was sadly a bit of a fright with smallpox scars. Face like Deadpool and a body like a mum, that is overly chubby. Next sister is Amelia, who will be either sweet as anything or sharp as a razor with a tongue. She is just starting to lose her youthful good looks and yearns to go to the country to live the quiet life. Youngest of the eldest sisters is Carolyn Elizabeth, the loveliest and the best, the sweetest natures. She's got a mother's chubbiness and is already suffering from rheumatism. Suffering badly, with the family saying, oh, she's just putting it on. She is not putting it on. This poor kitty is in a lot of pain for a lot of the time and getting zero sympathy. These girls have been brought up without George and Carolyn being around, and so there's a bit of a strain in their relationship. The eldest Anne showed contempt of a dad, George. Carolyn doesn't seem to have any affection for Anne at all. All three have inherited their parents' pride, though, at being royals. All three love the pomp and ceremony. At least Anne got Carolyn's ability to charm. Fred can also meet the three younger kiddies, William, Mary and Louisa, who are a bit young to know what's going on. Fred will be smart and set out to charm his family. On the surface, it looks like that's working and we are a happy family, but maybe not. He is doing a Carolyn, being sweet as to his parents. Okay, there is a liveliness in his eyes that is indescribable and the most obliging address that can be conceived. But the crown of all his perfections is that just duty and regard he pays to the king and queen, with such a mixture of affection as if obliging them was the greatest pleasure of his life. That goes on to say that George and Carolyn received these good intentions with the utmost joy. But the records also say that George was petty towards Fred and Carolyn did nothing about it. Fred can have apartments at St. James while the older kiddies get their own houses. Fred can have pocket money of £24,000 a year when George had gotten £100,000 a year as Prince of Wales in the end. Fred will be formally made Prince of Wales, but there's going to be no cannon firing. Yeah, I said it was petty stuff. Carolyn will have a portrait done And in this one, she will have young William Augustus dressed up all nicely royal-like with her. There'll be other portraits of Carolyn and the kiddies, but not one of Carolyn and Fred. And what is the spare heir studying? Well, constitutional history at least, and law, military tactics, procedure, shipbuilding and architecture. Yeah, I guess it's an education for an heir. Yeah, little Georgie Handel there, still churning out the hits with Dixit Dominus, or The Lord Said. Immediately there into Vivaldi's Dixit Dominus. Nothing wrong with the Handel Dixit Dominus, it's just that Vivaldi's Dixit Dominus is better. Yeah, Team Vivaldi here, isn't it? George and Carolyn will bring back the public dining thing. Now this is a terrible time to be a courtier, just in case you've ever thought, oh, I wouldn't mind being a courtier in the old days, because you have to do the serving and the bringing out of dishes and that crap job. You're a waiter. A lady in waiting will get the meat job. So she has to take off the cover, carve the meat, serve the royal couple and the princes and princesses, all done while she's on her knees. Now look, if you're a waiter in modern times, my dear listener, don't be whinging about your job. Just think about if you had to do it on your knees and carve the meat at the same time. So this could cause anxiety for the ladies to do the serving, because they've also got to get the drinks for the lazy bloody royals. That's a tricky job, you've got to admit, it's a tricky job, so of course there's going to be a bit of stress there. The Countess of Berkshire wrote to one of the ladies saying, I don't know what to do, I'm quite ignorant of the behaviour that is due to Majesty. See, you don't even get a job description, they don't even tell you how you're supposed to do and what you're supposed to do, you're just supposed to know. Maybe, though, it wasn't that bad, because the Countess had follow-up letters saying it was impossible to see Carolyn and not love her. George held daily meetings with guys like churchy guys, courtiers and brainiacs. Carolyn will copy George and have her own meetings with people. But, of course, Carolyn stuffed it, didn't she? All those top poets and guys that were friends with Henrietta that she didn't give jobs to, they're not coming into a court, so her court will not have the best and brightest. Yeah, she fluffed it. Young Fred, likewise, will copy Dad and have his meetings. We also have a total of 9 royal birthdays each year. That's good news if you're a fashion merchant. You can sell lots of fancy clothing for these birthday events, because all the top people are supposed to get brand new clothes for every bloody birthday. Apart from that sort of stuff, the royals' lives sound like luxurious boredom to me. It will be a private breakfast of sour cream and fruits, and putting up with grumpy dad King George too. He's annoyed with Carolyn for eating a breakfast, annoyed with Amelia for failing to hear him, annoyed with young Carolyn for being fat, annoyed with William Augustus for standing awkwardly. George can then get stuck back into Carolyn because that's what he's like. He gets stuck into his missus. He loves her the bits, but he's awful to her. Carolyn will then be off for a walk, and despite her size, at this stage was a fast walker. That's going to change because she's just going to keep beefing up. Sarah Churchill recorded a story where Carolyn was off so fast she left the Lord Chamberlain and 2 princesses way behind. Lord Grantham, the Chamberlain, then met some guy who'd come in from the country and asked him if he'd seen a person, and if so, how far off were they? A country bumpkin said he'd met a jolly crummy woman and had been trying to kiss her. Lord Grantham said, "That was a queen, you dickwit." "Oh, no," says the country guy, falling to his knees. "Please speak in my favour, otherwise I shall surely be hanged for what I did to Her Majesty." Oh no, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, whatever happened to our poor Carolyn at the hands of this miscreant? Well, not much. When they caught up with Carolyn, she said, sure, he had a go, but I got the better of him. For a particularly fun morning out, Carolyn and the princesses might go and pick their own cherries for breakfast. Oh, what fun. Following hot on the heels of the happiness of picking one's own cherries comes the sadness of separation as King George heads on over to visit Hanover. Just George going, one of four visits he'll make, with this one lasting 4 months. He's not even taking his mistress, Henrietta, with him, and I think Henrietta and Carolyn are probably quite pleased. Carolyn will get full regency powers. Carolyn will tell anyone who will listen that she's totally sad at being parted from her dear sweetie. How true that was, I shall leave to you to guess at. Carolyn getting the regency gig was a surprise to nobody. Stuff was said at the silly behatting even, like, if thy outward form can thus surprise, oh, what a noble pleasure they would find. Could they but view the picture of thy mind. Yeah, shitty poetry. But it says, yeah, Carolyn's pretty smart. George and Carolyn have always looked like a team with a shared vision. They've hardly been apart. George's big opening address to the House of Lords had seen an unprecedented number of peers' wives in attendance. And at that House of Lords thing, it wasn't just Carolyn with George. He had his three eldest girls with him. The message was, it's the King and Queen show, not just a King Joe like old German George. The last Queen Regent we had was Mary II, standing in for William when he went Frenchy-bashing. William's regency stipulated that he could override Mary's decisions if he wanted, and had a specific clause saying as soon as he came back, he would be immediately back in charge. None of that for Carolyn. George's regency document says Carolyn's in charge. What will Carolyn do with this power? Well, she'll proceed with caution, ensuring that George gets more confident in her. On her third regency, it will look like we're poised for biff with Spain, and George will write saying, look, just trust Carolyn, follow her orders. Well, that's a biggie. No, this seems to be particularly stressful for Carolyn. Courtiers and Fred are noting that she seems pretty darn relaxed with George out of England. What about the poor little Fred, Prince of Wales, the King in Waiting? Should he not at least have got joint regency? Some day shall see the royal sceptre thine, glad be that day, but late before it shine. No way on that regency, kiddo. Fred will play it cool. He'll be the first in to swear loyalty to the regent, Carolyn. With George out of the way, Carolyn will go and visit people. One of these will be that Duke of Newcastle, who George hates. Breakfast with Walpole, dinner with the Earl and Countess of Orkney, all good fun, and Fred will be with her every time. Carol and Fred will invite themselves to the Duke of Grafton's hunting box, even though the Duke was not happy about that arrangement. It's the happy family coming, with Fred and his sisters cracking jokes about the Duke. It can't be all fun, so back to work. Carolyn has a regency council to help, so it'll be meetings for this lot. There's not a lot to do, though, because there's to be no policy making. That was one of George's stipulations. You don't make policy, just react to whatever happens using the existing policies. Foreign affairs types have mostly gone with the King, because, really, the King is where the action is. There are some matters on the go. Finalising the Treaty of Seville. Concluding hostilities for a bit. No mention of Gibraltar in that treaty at all. Let's all just pretend it doesn't exist for the minute. Carolyn will chat to the Portuguese ambassador about their embargo on our shipping in the River Tagus. She will get that embargo removed, say well done, and in comes a well done letter from George. She will send a present of a dozen hogsheads of cider and perry to Louis XV. Now, perry is like cider, but it's made from pears, if you're wondering. These days we just call it pear cider, but back in the day it was perry. And it's a present to Louis because things are starting to deteriorate once again between us and the Frenchies, as they do. Look, let's face it, they're Frenchies, they're weird. We're going to hate them from time to time. Oh, look, here comes a present from the colonies in America. Whatever could it be? It is a live beaver. Oh, thank you, that's just what we wanted.
Leave it to Beaver.
Ah, yes, a marvellous American sitcom, but not really a segue, was it?
This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping now. This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. What I'm whipping
up. Yeah, a bit of Childish Gambino there. That's a bit better of a segue. As for George, well, this is the only second time he's been away from his dear sweetie. The first time was when he went playing soldiers there earlier on. He writes mostly every day to her. Oh, isn't he sweet? Well, in fact, he writes twice a day, once to the regent and then one letter to his missus. In the one to his missus, he can tell her about the German chicks he is banging. Oh, isn't that sweet, sharing there with Carolyn. And the methods used in said banging. Ah. Oh. Carolyn, being pragmatic, will write long letters back, making suitable comments about the women that he used for his sexual gratification. Carolyn will do nothing to cause George any upset at all. Her court was set at Kensington rather than flamboyant Hampton Court. Hampton Court might have been seen as a little bit in competition with him. The biggest party will be to celebrate George's Ascension Day while he's away, with plenty of letters to him saying who came and how it went, and they all loved you, George. All his replies are approving. There is going to be no need for George to think about anybody else's regent in the future. It'll be Carolyn. Time for George to come home and Carolyn will do a nice job of stage management. She and the kiddies will set off from Kensington, walking towards St. James's. They will meet George while he's still in his carriage. George will hop out and the two will have a nice big old public hug. It's an improvised scene of domestic bliss and harmony for the mob. And we all continue to love Carolyn to bits. Carolyn here. George, not so much. We had our suspicion he was turning into his dad in the I Love Hanover More Than England thing. Now he's visited the place, he has reverted to full-on German. He's had enough of this bloody English food. He wants Rhenish soup every day. The English, he's noticed, have got bad manners. They've got stupid customs and this stupid idea of a stupid constitution is, well, it's stupid. Oh, we hate the Constitution. Now tell the cooks to get in some sausages for dinner. Our English will soon find their xenophobia kicking back in, and George gives zero fucks about it. Now, where did we leave Henrietta Howard? Let's see. She's 40. She should be on top of the world, you'd think. She's managed to ditch her dead shit husband, Charles, has built a lovely house, but life at St. James no longer appeals. How do you dump your boyfriend if he's a bloody king, while trying to resign your job with the Queen? Well, you can't really resign from the royals. Can it be worse? Well, yeah, it's called too much of a good thing. The royals still have their routine of receptions, balls, and formal meetings, and that ceremony stuff. But it's been going on like that for 12 years. So, look, it's a good thing. It was good when it started, but after 12 years, it's bloody well boring. That's my thing about hell, my dear listener. I reckon no torture can go for eternity. It's got to get boring. Anyway, maybe that is what hell's about. Maybe hell is just boredom. Maybe they just sit in a room. I don't know what they do. George is driving people mad with his need for everything to be timed down to the second. Yes, he's still on that time thing. Why not make it summer so that it can be hot? Has anybody invented air conditioning? No, not yet. The new newfangled invention, the bath, is there, but has anybody taken it up? Not much, so it is not really just we commons who are smelly, my dear listener. You can be noble and smelly at the same time. Going for a game of cards at the Royals then might mean you're going to be hot and putting up with other people's body odour, and noble body odour is not any better than common smelly body odour. What does Lord Harvey have to say? Dice, dancing, crowding, sweating and stinking in abundance as usual. Harvey's talking about the fun nights. There's also the private nights where unhappy people are invited. You could set your watch by what time George sat down to play quadrille or whatever for the set amount of time that he plays quadrille or whatever, while you get to sit there and watch him play. The Duke of Grafton managed to nod off and stay asleep for the rest of the evening. Lord Grantham was noted for just wandering off around the palace, probably looking to crack his 10,000 steps for the day. Finally, the king would stand up, signalling the end of the game, and you can all go home. Off to bed after another long and dreary evening. It's the problems of the rich, my dear listener. Very real. The court will move, as it does, from wherever to wherever, but the tedium of the routine just travels with it. Henrietta is full of complaints. Her letter writing will ramp up to relieve the boredom. Lady Harvey writes frequently, and we can see Henrietta longs for Lady Harvey's life in the country, while Lady Harvey, oddly enough, misses the fun days when she was a young maid of honour at the court, being all naughty and frivolous. We want what we don't have, my dear listener. It's a curse on we humans. Lady Harvey goes for walks, but says her current friends are not alive at all. They're just in books. Yeah, well, that's what she's kind of saying. Her friends are all in books because it's boring where she is. Henrietta writes back saying, look, the old fun days are gone anyway, and the people in your books are more alive than I am. I envy what I cannot have. Oh, I just said that, Henrietta. You envy what you cannot have. It's our curse. Henrietta may be fibbing, though. The current maids of honour seem wilder than the lot in her days, particularly Anne Vane, who found young Fred, the Prince of Wales, flying around like a lovesick puppy. It won't take long for Anne to submit to Fred's lust. The clothes didn't do it, nor the jewels. But when he gave her a house, well, it was, oh, come on, Fred, have a go. It won't be long before we have a maybe royal bastard. Maybe because the gossip was that the boy was Lord Harvey's and not Fred's. But Anne will smartly have him baptised Cornwall FitzFrederick. Henrietta, though, is too old for the girlish fun of the maids of honour. Their running around giggling keeps her awake at nights. She's complaining about their girlish behaviour. Days aren't much better for Henrietta. She's expected to go on the hunts, but her age and condition aren't suited to this stuff. Before you know it, she's got the headaches back. Her loneliness at court will improve a bit when a brother, John Hobart, comes back into her life. She'd managed to get him Treasurer of the Chamber for George too, and that allowed him to buy a house on, is it Pall Mall or Pall Mall? Oh, take your pick. You know the place. It's on the Monopoly board. He brings his daughter Dorothy to London so Henrietta can mother her. These two, John Hobart and Henrietta, are the last remaining siblings of that family. All the rest are gone. Henrietta's son, Henry, is now 18, and she's had no contact with him since he was 5. He had a typical education for a young noble, and is now off to Paris for further education. Henrietta made attempts to have people speak to Henry on her behalf, but it looks like Henry never tried to contact her. He will end up as MP for Beer Alston, which was the family traditional seat, that is, Henrietta's family. And from to score that, it is likely that he was helped by his uncle John Hobart. If he was grateful to Henrietta in any way, there is no record of it, and it looks like his father taught him to hate his mother. What is in the record, sadly, is that Henrietta eventually became afraid of a son, just like his dad. She avoided places where he might be. The affair between Henrietta and George is also not going that well. People should just break up rather than go through a slow deterioration of a relationship, and it can get nasty, and this one will. For George, it's probably his strong need for routine, but even that's being eroded as he starts to reduce the time of his nightly visits to Henrietta. He's also snapping at her in public. Her deafness isn't helping either. Karen's all cool with this, and it's one of the reasons why Henrietta is being kept on in her service. George might find a more attractive replacement if Henrietta goes. That's still the problem. All this is getting Henrietta down, and she's on sick leave. No, really, she is sick, but being denied leave by Carolyn. And that will make it worse, and she'll have a fever, so Carolyn will have to give her some time off. This is the start of some bad health for Henrietta. But, oh, hang on, she can find a cup of break. Now, you won't believe it, my dear listener, you won't believe it. Her brother-in-law, Edward, 9th Earl of Suffolk, has snuffed it. So, if Dedship Charles inherits the title, which he's going to, I can tell you that, then she will be Countess of Suffolk. That's nice, isn't it? But we still need to check in on the will. Edward didn't have a heck of a lot of cash left because, as usual, Dedship Charles had taken him to court over money. So the lawyers got lots of the money, and when he died, Edward only had a couple of £1,000 left. But he didn't leave it to Dedship Charles. He left it to Henrietta. Wahoo! That's not a lot of money, but for Henrietta, it's great. The title did go to Charles, I said that, so she is a countess now with a little bit of cash. Now, the big deal is that a countess is way too senior to be a woman of the bedchamber, so Carolyn either has to sack her or promote her. Well, that's not a bad choice. If Carolyn chooses promotion, then the Countess of Suffolk is actually senior enough to bypass Lady of the Bedchamber and take her direct to the big job, Mistress of the Robes. So it's either a substantial promotion or freedom for Henrietta. Sounds like a win-win. Carolyn doesn't want to lose that nice balance in court, keeping George from hunting a new mistress, so she's going to offer a promotion. You can be Lady of the Bedchamber if you like, Henrietta, or Mistress of the Robes. That means the Duchess of Dorset will be getting a sack. That will take Henrietta about 1 second to decide. Mistress of the Robes, thank you, with its salary of £400 and way less work. Queen Caroline's right and trusty well-beloved cousin, the Countess of Suffolk, was henceforth the most senior member of her household. Brilliant.
I'm sitting on top of the world, just rolling along, just rolling along. And I'm quitting the blues of the world, just singing a song, singing a song.
Here you go, 5 or 6 years of this podcast, and finally, we get a Doris Day song. Brilliant stuff, all round. For Henrietta, no more holding wash basins while kneeling. No more of much work of anything, really. Just overseeing the royal wardrobe with the ladies of the bedchamber doing most of the actual work. Apart from that, it's attending functions, opening dog shows or whatever. Regular attendance at court, though, is not required. Lovely letters coming from her friends saying how great this all is for her. Except for Jonathan Swift, of course, who writes a shitty little passive-aggressive type thing that suggests after this rise, Henrietta can expect a fall. Speaking of which, here comes Charles spitting chips because his brother left his cash to Henrietta. And we're back to the lawyers. How much cash has been spent defending against this dickhead, we all wonder. It will be a 2-year thing fighting that, but the dead Earl had dotted his I's and crossed his T's and left no wriggle room in his will. I find it odd that Dedship Charles got any lawyers to take his case given his reputation for failing to pay. Charles has got the title. He got Audley End Estate and he got a couple of generations of debt on Audley Estate, which along with his own debts gave him a heap of trouble. Henrietta just got the title, the cash and a bit of happiness. She can sit around reading that agreement she'd got Charles to sign previously, which means she has zero association with his debts and the universe has for once perhaps delivered a bit of justice. Word of Henrietta's new title and her promotion to Mistress of the Robes is, of course, newsworthy. You could read about it in the Gentleman's Magazine or the Craftsman and any reputable publication in between. Gossip magazines are speculating on who will be the replacement woman of the bedchamber. Henrietta's archenemy and fellow woman of the bedchamber, Charlotte Clayton, was totally pissed off that Henrietta got a big promotion.
but the word was out that Henrietta looked pretty miserable on day one of a new job. No need, as Henrietta will soon learn that, for Carolyn, the protocol of dressing rituals was more important than the need to constantly put Henrietta down. Henrietta's main task now is putting on the bling at the end, the final little touches. This will actually be a win-win situation. Carolyn will treat Henrietta way better, and Henrietta had a sense of style and fashion, so Carolyn looks even better than before. Henrietta can use the diplomatic service to help out with things like getting fine Italian leather for the Queen's gloves or gold fabric for dresses. Henrietta will soon be noted as a highly successful dresser of the Queen. Even the Duke of Dorset, whose missus had to get the sack to let Henrietta have the job, will say, "I believe more rich clothes were never seen together, except at St. James's, and some of them so well chosen that one would have sworn a certain countess of my acquaintance had given her assistance upon this occasion." Before you know it, Henrietta has the job of ordering the clothes for the princess's weddings. Henrietta now has the right job and circumstances to spend time away from court. She can hang out at her house, but will also go visiting people. Her letters are less frequent because she now spends more time face to face with her friends. It's all very nice, but of course for Henrietta, it's a glimpse of what life could be like permanently if she could just get away from the court. Carolyn, though, is just not letting her go. Let's be in 1729 so that John Gay can put on the beggar's opera to make fun of Walpole. Walpole was hopping mad, but George and Carolyn had seen it and thought it was very funny. So there was nothing Walpole could do but put up with it. John Gay will soon write a sequel called Polly. Apparently Polly will be about a highwayman who looks rather like Walpole, robbing everyone in England. Yeah, that's about Walpole and taxation. We'll get to that. But Walpole will get in ahead of time with this play Polly and have the thing banned before it can be performed. John Gay will do a print-on-demand deal. That is, if you want a printed copy of his play, just put your name on a list. And so that list kind of becomes a declaration of your politics and your loyalty to the Walpole political regime. If your name went on the list, well, you're an enemy of the people. For Walpole, you're either with us or against us. Yeah, unlike that fluid stuff, say gender, where I believe those crazy Americans have now found something like 72 and a half different genders. Politics is binary. You're with us or against us. And think carefully before you put your name on that list. The Duchess of Queensbury thinks it's all the hoot and will tell everyone they really should put their name down on the list and read that play. She will even suggest to George that he put his name on the list, even though it was his Lord Chamberlain who had issued the ban on the thing. George will go all goggle-eyed and become a giggling schoolboy because that Duchess was rather dishy. He'll be off to tell Carolyn all about it and about what the lovely Duchess has got to say, and Carolyn will shove him firmly back in his box. George will have to banish the Duchess from court. Our dishy Duchess will send back a thank you note saying, "What a lovely command to stay away from the court where I never came for a diversion." Ooh, that's a bit cheeky, Duchess. Henrietta will now step into that role of play promoter for her friend John Gay. She will suggest to the royals that they reverse their ban because people are getting a bit resentful. And hey, John Gay has always been totally loyal to the crown. If there was time travel, I'd pop back and ask Henrietta if she was hoping to get a similar letter to the Duchess of Queensbury. That is, go away from court. The whole thing, though, will be a storm in the teacup, and John Gay will get notoriety out of it. Lots of people at court will have nothing to do with Gay, but Henrietta will stick by him. He's now living out with the Duchess of Queensbury anyway, and they'll be firm friends. Henrietta will write to both of them, and they will send joint replies. Henrietta and John Gay will become very close friends, with Gay looking at buying a house next door to her at one stage. But John Gay was a hedonist. He loved the booze, he loved the tucker, hated exercise. He will get very fat. He'll cop a fever, with everyone saying, "Oh, look, he'll get over it. He's only young." He won't get over it. Silly bugger will drop dead. There will be much boo-hoo-hooing. Jonathan Swift won't be able to bear to hear his dear dead friend's name. The Duchess of Queensberry will write to Henrietta. I often want poor Mr. Gay, and on this occasion extremely. Nothing evaporates sooner than joy untold, or told, unless to one so entirely in your interest as he was, who bore at least an equal share in every satisfaction or dissatisfaction which attended us. It's a satisfaction to once have known such a good man. As you were as much his friend as I, 'tis needless to ask your pardon for dwelling so long on his subject. Now, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, I might bag the poetry very frequently, but it's hard to bag the letter writing of the time. So much nicer than their little texty things with emojis. Henrietta has lost a pen pal in John Gay, so we'll write more frequently to the Earl of Chesterfield, who you might recall was banished to some diplomatic post in the Lowlands. He is bored to bits and has been petitioning the crap out of the government to be allowed to come home. 1732, and here he is looking for revenge on Walpole. So, we need to catch up with Wally Pole. And that means we're going to have to get into churchy stuff. And an update on the churchy stuff might take a little bit of time, but look, we've got plenty of time left today. So let's make a start on that. And allow me to present to you Dr. Jacques Stern, who we might call a Walpolean churchy types. Walpolean being a word that came into being due to Walpole. Very handy for your promotion prospects being a Walpolean, as I shall now point out. Kicked off as Rector of Rise in the East Riding of Yorkshire at 26 in 1723. He would add in 1729 the benefice of Hornsey cum Riston, then a fortnight later the York Minster prebend of Aikthorpe. He exchanged that in 1731 for Euskelf because there was more money there, acquiring in 1734 a further prebend at South Muscombe, which was attached to a distant Southwell Minster, before finally at 40 emerging as the Archdeacon of Cleveland and Precentor of York with an income of £900 a year from church livings alone. That would be double of one of the minor bishoprics. And he lived in the wing he purchased of one of York's great buildings, the Treasurer's House. Yeah, Sharks is here for baby Jesus and to make a shit ton of cash. He was, of course, a very good Whig man, helping out in elections. If I might just digress to the future, less than 20 years, he'll end up being a judge following a rather big Jacobite uprising. There'll be none of that baby Jesus mercy from Jacques. He will also work hard on trying to prove certain Tories were Jacobites, but you've got to have evidence, which was a bit of a problem for him there. This guy will come into contact with his rather famous nephew, Lawrence Stern, who is the author of The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy, Gentleman. Jacques' first chore for Lawrence is to write a favourable bit of text for a Whig candidate. Lawrence will do that, and it turns out that he can write very well. Then it will be set up a newspaper in York to counter the filthy Tory rag. The York Courant spewing its hideous poison propaganda each week. Oh, that is the enemy of the people, all right. So, Lawrence will attack them for being filthy Jacobites and evil Catholics. Yeah, pretty easy there. The York Courant will respond saying that Lawrence is a political hireling. Yeah, pretty spot on too. Then it'll be take on the Tory candidate. We're going to accuse him of being an Irishman. At that time, the allegation of being an Irishman was pretty darn serious. Someone calling themselves J.S. will come to the Tory's defence, saying he's not Irish. Jacques wants Lawrence now to identify who is this J.S. guy. Yeah, well, you see, Lawrence wasn't an investigative journalist, you dick, but he will come up with a J.S., James Scott, clergyman, but that turned out to be wrong. Matters will heat up, and Lawrence will be beaten up in the streets of York. Apart from
being somewhat of a comic genius, Lawrence was a typical churchy type. He got a churchy job to pay his income. He went to Cambridge, which was pretty Whiggy, while Oxford was pretty Tory. So did his time at uni, came out to a churchy job, wrote a book that the church liked so much they had it burned, but that didn't harm his churchy career because he was writing propaganda for the Whigs. But he will get the total shits in the end with political propaganda and say, ah, no more of that propaganda from me. And that's basically it. That's the end of his churchy career. Mate, you've got to do the politics or you're out. For churchy jobs in this time, we still have plenty of land owners who are Tories and they can hand out front of house magician jobs. The big jobs, though, get handed out at the top levels, and running the top levels are the Whigs. When Walpole wandered into the top job, the church was already dominated by Whigs. Well, the high church, the senior guys, 19 out of the 26 bishoprics were Whig supporters. It's a bit problematic, though, with the bishops being Whiggy and lots of front of house magicians being Tory. Perhaps we can have a squeeze at one of the top churchy types to see how our English church is going. So, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, now meet Lancelot Blackburn, the Archie of York and Buccaneer. What you say? Yeah, you heard me. Archie of York and Buccaneer, that's what I said. Those two jobs go very well together. The Buccaneer bit is a little bit sketchy, and we should always take into account that a Buccaneer might be a totally legit privateer one day, and a change in government policy then makes him an outside-the-law Buccaneer. Lancelot's role might also have just been a chaplain on a Buccaneer or a privateer ship, something like that. We also know he scored £20 from Charles II for Secret Services. So, Buccaneer, spy, Archie. Okay. Perhaps we could turn to that trustworthy source, Brewer's Rogues, Villains and Eccentrics, to see what they've got to say. His behaviour was seldom of a standard to be expected of an archbishop. Well, that could be something to do with his actions. As soon as the service ended in the cathedral, he'd ask for his pipe, tobacco and ale, thanks. The Dictionary of National Biography refers to his reputation for carnality and lax morals. Yes, he did like the girlies and a bit of the banging around. Perhaps you'd like a pamphlet on him. Priestcraft and Lust, or Lancelot and His Ladies. Walpole wrote of a man having all the manners of a man of quality, though he had been a buccaneer and was a clergyman, but he retained nothing of his first profession except his harem. If I haven't sold you on this guy yet, there's more. He's a latitudinarian. I think I've said the word right. Don't the churchy types come up with these weird words? Latitudinarian. That's his theology. That is, you allow plenty of latitude in the magical beliefs. Yeah, chill out, my congregation. Just love the baby Jesus, sing some happy clapper songs, and come to the after party. This Archie was also noted as being lazy and great. I'm becoming a fanboy of Lancelot, but the point is, this is not the guy who should be getting the rocket promotions in a Christian church. But he's the right guy for the time. He's a good party man, and he doesn't want to interfere. He just wants to sit around, chill, smoke his pipe, bang the ladies. Yeah, great. Some gossip. Only gossip, but good gossip, so I'll share it with you. It was said that Lancelot conducted a secret wedding between German George and Melusine. Unlikely. I think that after Sophia Dorothea, old German George would have sworn off marriage. Irrespective, our Archie had gotten a gig as chaplain to German George and soon became one of the boys. Walpole thought he was just fine and dandy, and sure, if you're in power, then a churchy guy who's happy to chill out is just great. Our Archie will soon be giving up a lot of the Archie-type work, the admin, visiting bishops and magicians. These guys know what to do. They've been doing it for 1700 bloody years. And eventually he'll give up stuff like confirmation. It wasn't just taking his hands off the wheel and pressing autopilot. He actually got himself some handy deputies to do the actual work. One of these being Dr. Jacques Stern. And I'll look at that. I've circled back to Dr. Jacques Stern. Currently, our method of dealing with church and state is... Oh, I've got another fucking new word. Erastianism. Oh, that's not too bad, Erastianism.
That is, the government dictates to the church, tells the church what to do. Comes from a Swiss Calvinist, Thomas Erastus. Well, kind of Calvinist. Am I heading down a rabbit hole? Nah, let's just tidy it up. Erastus reckoned that it was down to the government only to punish naughty people. So even if you commit an offence against the church, the government gets to hand out the stick. The church must continue to provide its very necessary services, like the sacraments, even to naughty people. So there you go. Look, he's a nice guy, Tom, saying don't punish people by withholding the sacraments. And that got picked up by the government and turned into the church has to do what we have to say. Oh, look, don't ask me to take you through it step by step. The government just worked it out themselves. They said, yes, this means the church has to do what we say. Now we can apply that in a practical way to England. Who is running stuff is the question. I have the answer for you. It's Robert Walpole, the Duke of Newcastle and the Lord Chancellor of the day. They called the shots and the church submitted, and I'm glad we've cleared that up. Is it much different, though, than when Henry VIII declared himself the head of the church? Back to power, and who wields it? Back in, say, 1714, when German George first turned up, the Whigs had the bishoprics pretty much tied up, but the Tories had the magicians out there in large numbers. Stanhope and Sutherland stuffed up pretty soon after when the Archie of Canterbury came up and they appointed this Whig guy, William Wake. Wrong choice, lads, because he was inflexible in certain churchy views, the views of his political masters were interested in. It is that stupid bit of legislation, the occasional conformity bill, where you need to come into the true church once a year to get your bit of bread without yeast, your slaggle house bread, and then you can get your job because you've been conformed for this year. Front of house magicians could smell the bullshit there, and they weren't happy at all. Henry St. John, Viscount Bolingbroke, was working with churchy types to get rid of that ability to conform so we could stick it up the dissenters and fine the crap out of them, while the Whigs were committed to dismantling the whole thing right back to Charles II and the Test Act. Get rid of it all and do the magic show of your choices, Whig policy. Hey, we've got a Whiggy Archie, so what about it, William Wake? Are you with us? Not bloody likely. Well, that's not helpful at all. What about the bishops? Are they with us? The bishops are all over the shop with it, and their leader, the Archie, is dead set against dismantling the whole thing. We're unhappy. We need to fix it. But we'll have to fix it next week. And just a little bit there of Died Too Young Gary Moore to get us into some historical fiction. And once again, it's a movie, and once again, it's a Frenchy movie. This will be delicious, and the movie is absolutely delicious. It is a feast for your eyes, my dear listener. So we're set just before the French Revolution, once again, and we're with a guy who is not just a cook, he's an artist, this guy. So he's working for a duke, because we've got two different types of food going on. You've got the food for the rich and famous, like the Duke. He's got to have all this really fancy food, and then everybody else gets to eat whatever swill. But our master chef manages to get himself the sack, and off he goes to open what's going to be a restaurant. Now, restaurants had actually been invented in France just a bit before where this movie is set. But prior to that, we still had the idea of public eating, going out and paying for food with inns and whatever. But this is just, you go and get a bowl of gruel, you get some sort of rancid meat on a trencher, which you might recall as a bit of bread. But this guy is going to open a restaurant, something that serves fine food for people of whatever class to come and enjoy, so long as you can afford it. But the whole thing is, back to what I said at the start, this is delicious to look at. It is just gorgeous on your eyes. So, delicious, a movie. Knock yourself out. But for us, it's just a matter of what we go out with. And what came up on the playlist the other day that made me sing along was the Four Non-Blondes song, What's Up? So that's what we're going out with. Hope to see you next week. Bye.